according to Ajahn Sawant, there are two Dharma themes that Ajahn Mun would talk about more than anything else. One was the customs of the noble ones. And the other was the practice of the Dharma in line with the Dharma. And the two themes are essentially the same, that we practice the Dharma not in line with our preferences, but in line with the way the Dharma really is. We also practice not in line with other people's preferences. This, for Ajahn Mun, was a really live principle. And of course, it's live for us today. Looking at the forest tradition in Thailand, we tend to miss the fact that when Ajahn Mun was starting out into the forest, same with Ajahn Sao, they met with a lot of resistance. People kept accusing them of not following Lao customs or Thai customs. And Ajahn Mun would say, well, the customs of Laos and the Thais, as the customs with any country, are the customs of people with a defilement. Indian customs, American customs, European customs. These are all shaped by defilement. He was interested in becoming a noble one, which meant that he had to follow the customs of the noble ones. That's why he's very strict in his observance of the Vinaya, the ascetic practices. And it caused a lot of controversy. I was reading recently a conversation that Ajahn Chah had with some lay people. He talked about how Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Sao tended to create controversy wherever they went. The ecclesiastical head of that area had asked them to go out and teach the Dharma to people. And so they went out, and as Ajahn Chah said, they taught the truth, which was very different from what was normally taught. You get families falling apart, husbands arguing with wives, children with their parents, because they take what Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Sao taught and they compare it with what the other monks were teaching. And the question was who was right. And more they would check the texts as they became more available. And they began to realize that Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Sao were right. This is what the Buddha actually taught. So in following what the Buddha taught, there's always going to be some controversy. So it's a matter both of not following your own preferences and not following the preferences of other people. You've got to look and see what the Dharma teaches, what the Vinaya teaches, because it's a training. It's not a product that's for sale. Of course, this issue is very alive with us. As the Dharma comes west, there's always that temptation to turn it into a more palatable kind of teaching to fit in with American tastes or European tastes, Canadian tastes. But we have to watch out for that, because bit by bit by bit the Dharma disappears. And it's always important to think about the trouble that Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Sao went through in order to reestablish a teaching that was closer to the customs of the noble ones and closer to the practice of the Dharma in line with the Dharma. When the Dhammayu Monastery started having abbots' meetings, they were inviting the senior monks over from Bangkok, and so of course they would have meals on tables, people eating with plates. And then Ajahn Sawat was the odd man out. He would always eat in his bowl. And so he was asked by the other monks to please stop eating in his bowl, at least for the duration of the meetings, to sit at a table and eat off plates like everybody else. And as he said, as he told them, it's not that he was trying to show that he was better than anybody else. But he said simply, he thinks about Ajahn Mun and all the hardship Ajahn Mun went through in order to reestablish his practice, eating out of the bowl. and felt sorry for him. It seemed such a shame to throw it away so quickly. As he told the monks, well, if you see that my eating out of the bowl is causing controversy and disharmony, I'll just not come to the meetings. They backed down. And sure enough, as soon as he stopped going to the annual meetings, the pressure came again. I was told that by eating in the bowl, I was making life difficult for the lay people. But then I asked the lay people, and they all said they'd be happy to provide food for monks eating the bowl. So there was that one day when I was the only one eating out of the bowl. And then sure enough, the next day, a few of the other monks who had been trained in the forest tradition started bringing out their bowls and eating in the bowls as well. So you never know when the pressure is going to come from. But I've always liked that comment from Ajahn Sawada. It's not that we're trying to be better than other people. We just think about all the hardship that Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Sao and all the other forest Ajahns went through in order to reestablish this practice. And if we let it go, then someplace down the line, someone else is going to have to go through all those hardships again. So you want to hold the line. And not give in to that desire simply to be pleasing to other people. So the practice of the Dharma in line with the Dharma is, of course, meant to make you look more seriously at your defilements and to see that they really are defilements. This is another teaching that tends to go against the grain here in the West. People don't like being told that they have defilements in their minds. So how they feel about it is their business, but you have to look at your own mind. Are the thoughts that you dwell on obscuring the mind, making it dark, making it harder for it to see things clearly? That's one of the problems with the hindrances, is that they deceive you. When sensual desire comes in, there's a part of the mind that wants to side with it and say, yeah, that object really is desirable. When ill will comes in, that person really is horrible. They really deserve to suffer. When some sleepiness comes in, oh, yeah, the body really needs some rest. Restlessness and anxiety come in. Those are things you really do have to worry about. Uncertainty comes in. Oh, yeah, that really is uncertain. And if you're not on the lookout for this kind of thing, you just get swallowed up by these ways of thinking. And they're your old patterns of thought. It's so easy to fall into those old ways. Which is why it's good to keep that principle of the Dharma in line with the Dharma. What does the Dharma have to say about your thoughts? What does it recommend that you do with those thoughts? What are the standards for deciding what's skillful and what's not? And be willing to hold yourself to that standard. There's that old saying from the Zen patriarch that the great way is not difficult for those with no preferences. There's only one way that that makes sense, which is that you don't let your preferences get in the way of following whatever the path tells you to follow or to do. I mean, you do have the preference of wanting to put an end to suffering, of wanting to train the mind, to follow through with all the skills of the Four Noble Truths, to comprehend suffering, abandon its cause, realize its cessation by developing the path. That preference you don't abandon. But the preferences that would go against those duties, those are the ones that you have to learn how to put aside if you want to practice the Dharma in line with the Dharma so you get the results of the Dharma in line with the Dharma. If your practice deviates from that principle, then of course the results are going to deviate. The same principle goes with the customs of the noble ones. The texts mention this principle in two places. One is in the commentary, where the Buddha returns to his home. And the first day he's there, he goes out for alms. And the king, his father, tries to stop him. He said, "This is disgraceful. Nobody in our family has ever followed this practice of going out and begging in the streets." This is not one of our traditions. This is not one of our customs. And the Buddha says, in his essence, he says, "Well, I'm sorry to inform you, I'm no longer following the traditions of the family. I'm following the traditions of the noble ones, the customs of the noble ones. And going for alms is one of those customs." So when you're ordained, you really are setting yourself out against the normal customs of lay society. From their point of view, going out for alms is disgraceful. From our point of view, it's a pure form of livelihood. We eat what people give. We don't beg, we don't ask, but whatever they freely give, that kind of food is blameless. The other place in the text where they talk about the customs of the noble ones are four practices or four attitudes. The first three have to do with your requisites. You're content with whatever clothing you're given. You're content with whatever food you're given. You're content with whatever shelter you're provided with. And you watch out for the dangers that come from eating food and wearing clothing and using shelter. What would those dangers be? Well, you get attached to these things. And then if you're content with very little, you start getting proud of the fact that you're content with little, and you look down on those who are living more luxuriously. So there are dangers in both directions. You have to be watchful for those. Remember, you're not here to compete with anybody else. You're here to compete with your own defilements. Treating your own disease. It's like being in a hospital. There may be other people in the hospital who aren't taking their medicine. You can't really do anything about that. You're there to take your medicine because you've got a disease, not that you're going to try to win a contest of being a better patient. So the customs of the noble ones on the one hand, for those first three customs, have to do with contentment on the one hand and watching out for pride on the other side. Now, there is an honor to practicing the teaching. It is a dignified teaching that we're practicing, but you do have to watch out for that tendency to compare yourself with other people. So there's a fine line between healthy pride and unskillful pride. And you always want to keep that distinction in mind. Now, given that the first three of the customs have to do with the requisites, you would think that the fourth would have to do with medicine, but it doesn't. The fourth one is to delight in abandoning and to delight in developing. In other words, you try to delight in abandoning unskillful qualities and to delight in developing skillful ones. Normally the mind goes in the other direction. The mind delights in pride, it delights in its lust, and it delights in its anger. It really likes to feed these things. And when it comes to giving these things up, it resists. Then there are the skillful qualities of mind that you have to work to develop. You wake up in the morning, it just seems really hard to get up. You start telling yourself, "Well, it's not going to make any difference if I miss this one meditation session. And I've had all these other sessions, I don't have much to show for them, and so why bother?" And we can tell you all kinds of things to not want to get up and make the effort. And so you have to learn not only how to get yourself up, but also to delight in getting up. To look forward to the fact that you do have the opportunity to practice. Another day has come, you're still alive. the opportunity to practice is here. You learn to delight in that. And as for seeing the greed go away, or the lust go away, or the anger, you've got to train yourself to delight in those things as well. This, of course, connects with that factor in right effort, generating desire. Learning to want to follow the practice. If something has to be abandoned, you learn how to delight in figuring out how to do it. The qualities of the mind that need to be developed: mindfulness, alertness, concentration, discernment. Try to be up for the challenge. That's how you maintain the customs of the noble ones. Since you can become a noble one as well. That's what this is all about. All the noble ones of the past, they didn't start out being arahants. They all started out just like us, people with defilements filling their minds. Yet they recognized the defilements as defilements, saw them as a problem, able to dig around inside until they found the strengths and potentials within their own minds that they could develop and turn into the path. Taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha to the point where they become a member of the noble Sangha and become an object of refuge to others too. It's in this way that following the path, you not only follow the customs of the noble ones, you keep them alive for other people too. Both as you practice, and if you happen to reach the end of the path, as John Swart used to say, as you're following the path, you try to keep it as free of weeds as possible, because you want to get to the goal. Once you've arrived at the goal, then whether the path gets covered with weeds, as far as you're concerned, your own personal needs, doesn't really matter. But you look at other people, you see them struggling along. And so you don't want to see other people put more weeds in the path, grow weeds in the path. You want to do what you can to keep the path as free of weeds as possible. So as the Buddha said, after he mentioned that the true way of paying homage to him was to practice the Dharma in line with the Dharma. And then he wanted to say, as long as the monks practice properly, practice rightly, the world will not be empty of arahants. This is a theme that you hear over and over again in the forest tradition. A lot of people seem to be practicing for the purpose of making sure there are no arahants in the world. But you can't police the waterfront that way. Your concern is the path is here, this is your opportunity. The more you can cleanse your mind of defilements, the more you're helping not only yourself, but also everybody else, to make sure that this is a world that still has some arahants. Keeping that point in mind is what keeps us practicing in line with the Dharma. This is another point where the Buddha says to practice in line with the Dharma is to practice for the sake of seeing things as inconstant, stressful, and not self, so you can give rise to a sense of disenchantment, dispassion that leads to release. If you make that the direction in which you're practicing, you're going to benefit, and it's going to benefit others as well. Remember the Buddha's teaching on the acrobats. You maintain your balance, it helps other people maintain their balance. When you're kind to others, it's a training for yourself. When you're being mindful and developing the purity of the mind. It's an act of kindness.